Welcome everyone. This is number two of what is now titled, which actually number one wasn't titled, but John and Jim's Excellent Journeys, I think we decided. I was going to go for Bogus Journeys, but then the initials and acronym was just not really what we really wanted. So we went with Excellent Journeys, which we kind of felt sort of reflected a little bit of the 80s, and it was a little bit of fun, and we kind of hope this is a little bit of fun. And there's a little bit of the 80s. So today, to sort of really grab that, we're going to do a little bit of the 70s instead. And it probably be a little bit dull and a little less fun. So I don't know. Kind of hoping this will be good. John Kenneth Muir, as I said last podcast, author, writer, what else should I call you? Father, nice person. Siri, what was that?
Siri calls me Master of the Universe. That's the...
Siri calls you Master of the Universe. Is that Siri's choice, or is that what you've told her to say to you?
That's what I told Siri to call me.
You see, I would love to do one on Filmation at some point, which again sit very nicely into this.
Absolutely.
I've been watching a lot of He-Man recently.
Oh no, I'm so sorry.
Oh dear. I think there's a lot to be said about He-Man. Obviously not today, but I think there's a lot to be said. A lot of good things. And, of course, Flash Gordon, which is a big favorite of mine. The Filmation one. So that would be really good as well.
I love Filmation. And you know, their 76 Tarzan and Star Trek. And then, of course, all their live action Saturday morning stuff.
Space Sentinels. I used to love Space Sentinels. That was really... I was really young when I used to watch that. So as you can get a feeling, this is a sort of very... what I call a rambly cast, or a ramcast. No, I don't. I don't call it that. it's just a rambly... a conversational podcast. There's no massive technical expertise here. It's just two people who will chat like this, who will deviate. I'm afraid there will be some ums and ahs as we just try and riff off each other. There is no set format. As I was saying to John before he came on, the idea here is really perhaps to give you something as you're running or you're jogging or you're going to work, and you've just got something that, to play on your playing machine, whatever that may be. Clearly, as we're both time-locked at this moment in, I suppose, 1975, if we're going for sort of like Space 1999, around about there, our recording machines are very different to your recording machines, so we're kind of hoping you have high-tech ones which you can carry around you. Clearly not as high-tech as Comlocks. They won't be as small as that, but we kind of hope they'll be almost that size. I don't know what they'll have in the future, because we've got a great situation here, because we're talking about a future from the past that's in the past now, that doesn't reflect the future, which is really cool. I really love that about Space 1999, because Space 1999 is what we're talking about. It's a television show that was... well, I'll let John go through all this, but was primarily British. But we'll be looking at, I think, more from... I'd like to look at it more from how it sort of functioned for America, because we talk... this podcast is goes under the veil of being about America, and Space 1999 is one of those shows which could be argued either way. So we'll look at it maybe from a sort of American perspective. My first question to you, John, before we go into it seriously, do you remember where you will be on September 13th, 1999?
Yes, I was...
Will. Because it's the future.
Where will I be?
Yes, right. Where will you was will be? Where, get with the tenses,
where
man.
Not where was I? I hope I will be on the moon, serving in some not dangerous capacity on... Moonbase Alpha with 310 other scientists, astronauts, preparing for a future that is fantastic and the ultimate journey.
That's a nice way of actually giving people a rough idea what Space 1999 was, if you didn't already know or will be, because it's the future in 1999. Where were you in 1999? Because I remember exactly where I was on September 13th, 1999. Can you? Yeah.
Okay, well, you tell me where you are. I want to know where you were first.
I was about to fly to the States, to Florida. And I remember sort of jovially saying to, I think, my girlfriend at the time, hey, look, this is going to be an interesting trip. I hope the moon doesn't get blasted out of orbit. Or something that wasn't very funny, but to me carried significance, and to her carried a blank face. And when I explained it, the blank face may have changed slightly to sort of a slightly annoyed face, but essentially it was a negative face. So yeah, I remember that clearly. I remember it being 1999. I remember being soon to be getting onto a plane to fly over to the States. How about you?
I was on a... Okay, now this is going to sound scary.
If you say if you were on the moon, I'd be quite shocked. And that whole thing beforehand wasn't just a joke. It was actually where you were.
Yeah, exactly. I was on the moon. No, I was standing on a ledge at a hotel in Los Angeles with my beautiful wife, Catherine.
This sounds suicidal, but carry on.
Yes, exactly. It sounds bad. And another writer friend, and we had all lit up cigars, and we were looking up at the moon, wondering if it was going to break away, because we were at the breakaway Space 1999 convention in Los Angeles.
How high? Johnny
Byrne was there, and Prentice Hancock was there, and Nick Tate, I believe, was there. Barbara Bain stopped in at some point. It was an amazing experience. Fred Freiberger actually was there at one point as well.
So we're playing Donald Trump now, are we? Are you going to trump my story with a really good story? Is that why you wanted me to go first? So you
could... Exactly. I thought, how can I one-up James?
Absolutely. Well done. You have succeeded. Okay, yeah. So 1999 was obviously a very important date. Can you give me the approximate... What year did it start? Was it 74?
It actually began airing in 75, but I mean, there was a very long lead up to its premiere.
Gotcha.
So I mean, I think that, you know, it actually began filming in the closing months of 73. It took a very long time to film that first season of 24 episodes, and they were all in the can and done before the first year, or as they like to say in Space 99 circles, year one, before year one ever aired. Those were all in the can. So, you know, when we talk about, you know, context, we were watching this, and well, I was. I think I don't know if you're old. Are you that old, James? Are you as old as I am?
I wasn't quite born yet, but
that's what I figured. I was 5 or 6 years old, I guess, in 1975. I guess I hadn't yet turned 6. I was 5 when it premiered. But when we talk about context, it was actually like playing off of what was happening a lot in 74, stuff like that. So, yeah, the premiere was 75.
So what was it playing off from 1974?
Well, I think if you look at a lot of what's going on in Space 1999, you're looking at a world that had gone through the OPEC oil embargo, lots of limitations on resources. You're looking at a world in which politics have failed. You know, the Nixon administration in deep crisis through 73, 74 with the Watergate scandal. And you're looking at a world where war is going on, but it's not achieving anything, certainly the American involvement in Vietnam. And if you look across year one of Space 1999, and year two to some extent, though not quite as much, because it was a more sort of action agenda at that point, the first year of 1999, we encounter beings who are like in endless wars. We encounter politicians who have failed, and that failure leads to catastrophe. And we're looking at a world in which we like need to get our natural resources, and resources are quite limited.
Right. Okay. So this leads to an interesting point. Just very broadly for people who are, I'm worried that people listening to this won't know what they're listening to. And if you are, you probably shouldn't be listening to it. But Space 1999 was a science fiction show that was, it was made by ATV. Was it ATV commissioned?
It was ITV.
Oh, ITV. Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. Jerry Anderson, Jerry and Sylvia Anderson created it, worked on the first year. Now, in the lead up to year two, Sylvia Anderson was no longer involved, and that's when Fred Freiberger, who produced the last season of Star Trek, third season, became involved as the producer. So,
but I mean, so correct me if I'm wrong, but so ATV actually produced it for ITV. It was made primarily for an American. They were looking to try and break the American market in exactly the way that Thunderbirds really hadn't.
Exactly. The idea was it was going to get a network buy, that it was going to air on. You know, at that point we had three major networks. Fox did not yet exist in the United States, so we had ABC, CBS, and NBC. And the idea was to get a sale to one of those networks, it would air in prime time, and it would be a major coup.
Yeah.
The networks, to some extent, didn't like being approached with a done deal. As I said, they had like 24 episodes of Space 1999 in the can, and that meant the networks couldn't say, do this, change this. So the networks didn't buy it, consequently, in the United States, and it had to go the route of syndication. And it's kind of funny because I read a lot of history books as far as science fiction, and so many laud Star Trek The Next Generation as like being the first science fiction hit in syndication, but you know, Space 1999 sort of pioneered that route in 1975, you know, over a decade before Next Generation was in syndication. And of course, there had been previous ones, not to the extent Space 1999, but The Star Lost in 1973 was also syndicated, though I think it broke maybe 80 markets in the United States, and Space 1999 had over 150 markets that it hit. So much so that its ratings, even though it wasn't on a network, it got higher ratings than some network shows. There was this nice conjunction of destiny where Space 1999 started airing in syndication on these local stations and drawing a huge audience, while what the networks had planned for 1975 was considered like the worst year of network television anywhere. So consequently, these new shows were coming on, not getting an audience, and people were going to Space 1999 instead. So it achieved pretty high ratings in its first year, at least initially, in part because the network offerings were so poor. So you can argue, wow, maybe the network should have taken Space 1999 instead of Barbary Coast, you know, with William Shatner and Doug McClure. So.
So it's quite an interesting beast. One of the reasons there is, as we'll talk about in a little bit, such a duality, because there was two seasons of Space 1999, and they were, in some ways, people would argue they were binary to each other. They were so far removed. So that was because the first season was in the can. It couldn't have any network intervention. However, by the time season two was made, there was a strong case for sort of involvement or an ability to be involved and to sort of what we could argue is Americanize it.
Yes. I don't have any. I don't have any animosity towards year two. We probably wouldn't have gotten a year two without the changes that were made. But a lot of those changes, not all of them, some of them were very interesting, and they added at least one new character who was quite intriguing. But the Americanization of the show in some way took away what made it so special, I guess, to some fans.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting show to really talk about because there's just so much you can talk about it. So if we start on year one, again, the premise of this show, for those who are still listening after 14 minutes or so, the premise of this show is the moon has essentially a moon base on it. The year is 1999, where we clearly have a sort of a far. Well, we don't actually. I mean, at the time, I thought they just went to the moon, but the suggestions later on that Earth has far greater abilities to actually move beyond the moon, but essentially Earth is a moon base, has a moon base on it, there's a nuclear accident, and it catapults it's actually better than it sounds, it catapults the moon out of Earth's orbit, and it goes on a sort of week by week wandering through outer space, meeting weird wacky adventures as they go along, and the moon base is run by Commander Koenig, who's played by American Martin Landau, and he's ably joined by by Barbara Bain. And suddenly her name escapes me.
Dr. Russell.
Yeah, Helena Russell, who is the medical doctor, and there's a whole group of other people who remain sort of stable cast members in a sort of Star Trek sort of ensemble piece, where you sort of have two to three key ensemble members and the rest play sort of a nice background filter of characters that are familiar each week but don't really have a horrendous amount to do or a horrendous amount of consistency. I'm talking about you, Alan Carter. I love Alan Carter, but there are times where, you know, in the opening episodes, he's almost virtually a coward in some of his arguments. I think in Black Hole, is it, where he's sort of very keen to not be the one who stays on Alpha, if I remember rightly.
Right.
And then later on, he's a far more sort of heroic character.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
So it's a very interesting series, as you say. I mean, it was done British. You were talking about what it was reflecting in 74. I mean, a lot of it was Johnny Pearson, wasn't it, who wrote a lot of the scripts? Not Johnny Pearson. I'm thinking of the... I've been watching All Creatures Great and Small, which is why I'm thinking of composers.
Johnny Byrne?
Yes, yes, Johnny Byrne was what I was thinking of. But
Christopher Penfold?
The season one writers, how many of them were reflecting British backgrounds of writing? I was just wondering how that sort of fed into the mix of these ideas that you were saying that Space 99 reflected, and how much of them reflected sort of British side to American side cultural and political issues.
Well, there was a lot of turmoil going in Great Britain as far as there was a strike going on, things like that, when Space 1999 was actually made. And if you go back to the 1970s, I think what a lot of people were arguing about, which you could say they're arguing about now, is, you know, what is the role of the state? How big should the state be? Is the state efficient? Is it not efficient? And I guess it was in Science Digest, which was a periodical that came out here in the United States, they said that Space 1999 was about the downfall, see if I get this right, of technological man. And it was kind of like, this world is messed up. And maybe it's messed up because of the strikes. Maybe it's messed up because of waste, you know, the nuclear waste, you know, pollution. You could read that into it. Maybe it's messed up because of war, or it's our whole political system. And this breakaway, which is a great title for the opening episode, is about the breakaway and the new beginning for Moonbase Alpha. It's like breaking away from the systems on Earth that have made Earth a failure. And even, you know, talk about the downfall of technological man, I guess they're looking at them saying, well, even technology hasn't saved us. And Johnny Byrne, you know, spoke often about Space 1999 as being like the origin story of a people, that you know, we were seeing the beginning of a civilization, you know, starting with this breakaway, where the people on the moon become separated from sort of the corrupt or failed system that exists on Earth. It's like, not, you can't improve. And it begins this cosmic journey where, you know, mankind has a second chance. So I think, you know, I think everything that was going on, whether you're looking in Great Britain or the United States or just globally, I mean, we're talking about, you know, OPEC and, you know, oil and how are resources being divided and things like that, is about this failure of existing systems to succeed and bring about the kind of future that people want. And even though Space 1999 begins with disaster, that the moon's waste dumps explode and it's hurled into outer space, even though it begins with disaster, it's the beginning of a second chance for those 311 scientists, astronauts, what have you, you know, stationed on Moonbase Alpha.
I think one of the things which always struck me about Moonbase Alpha, well, there's two things, and one of them will lead into perhaps a conversation about aesthetics, was one of the things which created the tension was the fact that the moon base, aside from a couple of episodes where they suddenly decide they have, are pretty much unarmed. They have very little in terms of defense, or of, well, they have certainly little in terms of offensive. They have some defensive features, but that sort of gave us a very nice tension to the show. As you say, while they have technology, and while technology is very much part of the aesthetic, it's not necessarily always part of the solutions, because they're always up against things which are far more highly technologically advanced. And you could argue that with Star Trek, but, you know, Eagles were technically just transporters. Their main vehicles, which were on Moonbase Alpha, the Eagle carrier, was not really, although, as I say, occasionally it was not really aimed at combat. So it gave a sort of feeling of that sort of and it's perhaps one of the first, I mean, people always talk about Star Wars being the first with a sort of utilitarian use of ships, that ships weren't these sort of prized silver rockets anymore, that even the Enterprise was to a degree, but something sort of more honed and more sort of used and worked in, sort of like a World War II Warcraft. So Space 1999 was sort of doing that, I kind of felt, with the Eagles. The Eagles were very pedestrian. They were very... the functionality was very much part of them. They were not made to, or designed to look like they were sort of super you know, attack rockets, as science fiction enjoyed. They were things to carry nuclear waste from one part of the base to the other part of the base, or to transport people from Earth to the moon. They weren't designed for the usual sci-fi exploits, which created attention.
Absolutely. And you know, you said so many smart things there that, you know, are worth talking about. The, you know, as far as the weapon, well, in year one, Moonbase Alpha never encountered an alien race that was either on their level or more primitive than their level. They always encountered more advanced life forms. I mean, there was the famous caveman episode, but mm-hmm. they were the cavemen they discovered.
Yes, that's true.
It wasn't an alien race. They were the primitive men in that episode, which is fascinating. But I remember I interviewed Johnny Byrne in the 2000s, and we were talking a little bit about Voyager, which had a sort of similar premise, a lone ship lost in a different part of space. It wasn't the moon, but it was, you know, humanity adrift sort of in space trying to find its way. And he said the key difference, and I'm not trying to pick on Voyager, I enjoy Voyager fine, but as far as defining space 1999, he said in Voyager they proceed on the basis that they have everything they need to survive, meaning holodecks, antimatter, whatever. He said Space 1999 was the opposite, which is that we had nothing we needed to survive, and that was the basis for our stories. We had to get the things, which sort of goes back to resources and things like that. But you're absolutely right about the Eagles. I mean, the only way that space travel is affordable, and you see it, you know, brilliantly in Space 1999, is that these Eagles are modular. They have different central sections. You know, you have this sort of magnetic winch part that you can put in to, like, lift up the nuclear waste. You have, like, a laboratory module. You have a first aid rescue module. And I guess Commissioner Simmons, who was a visiting, I don't want to say diplomat, I'll say politician, he had, like, his VIP Eagle. You know, it's like, the idea that you're going to be able to have this utilitarian modular craft which has this sort of dorsal spine, and that you can, like, lock in these different modules depending on what you need the ship to do. And even the pilot modules could be ejected, as we saw in certain episodes. So there was this, you know, functionality was more apparent, shall I say, here than in some science fiction shows. It was clear that the craft was thought out to some high level. And you're absolutely right. There were laser armed eagles, but they, like in the war episode, War Games, they pretty much got pasted by other ships. It's like, yeah, these are like utilitarian crafts, and they're not, you know, they're not fighting ships. Right? No. So I mean, you said some smart things there. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I that always fascinated me. In fact, my memories, if we go to Memories of Space 1999, the opening sequence of season one always had the Eagle crashing. You know, the first shot is of an Eagle, and they did that a lot. There was a lot of Eagle crashings, and I think the modular thing was very good, smart for the budget point of view as well, is that you weren't having to constantly create a whole range of different spacecrafts used by the main team. They would be the same one where you could do, like, and also call back to Thunderbird 2, where you'd sort of have this modular change section, which again also is quite smart for toy merchandising too.
Right, but you also had, like, you know, for different missions they could add external boosters to the mm-hmm. ship, to the Eagle. I think in one episode they added, like, a robot arm to grasp something. You know, so there was this feeling that, you know, the Eagle was like the workhorse of
yes.
whatever, the Earth fleet, and it you could modify it in so many ways, which makes sense because there are so many different kinds of things it had to do. So you would outfit it for the mission, which makes sense in terms of, you know, the cost of space travel, which is one of the things I love about Space 1999. I acknowledge that, you know, space adventuring is very expensive and opportunities, you know, come few and far between. You know, as they said in one episode, Dragon's Domain. It's like, yeah, it's true. I mean, it took into account, even though the premise of it sounds nutty, it really took into account sort of the reality of the 70s. It's like, you have to pay for this. We might have a moon base, but you're still going to have to pay for it. And we're going to have to figure out how to pay to have the ships there and stuff like that. And, you know, we want to do this mission, but it's expensive. So we got to figure out how to pay for it.
It was like a lot of shows of the, so well, not quite that era, but certainly of the 70s, where you'd have this feeling that there'd be a very smart idea, which would be perhaps made a little ludicrous by the way that television at the time needed to jump past certain issues. I mean, I'm thinking, like, another thing we'll talk about eventually is Kenneth Johnson's Incredible Hulk, where you have quite serious and clever issues, and even the Hulk itself is quite a clever issue, but it's sort of lost a little in the way that you need to construct television at the time, where you get the sort of ludicrous, sort of over-the-top music when the Hulk appears, and the jeans that don't really quite make sense, so they're sort of long flares on him, on Banner, but on the Hulk they're really like shorts, and it doesn't really work with the sizing and everything else. All those things you ignore. In the same right. space, 1999, the whole idea of the the moon being catapulted through the cosmos is ridiculous. There's very little science involved. While the Eagles certainly have a certain science about them, how they're used, how quickly they get to planets, all these sort of things. You know, you get this standard, you ignore these sort of things, and you can sort of, but you can still see those functional ideas within there, which sort of gives it its own realism. It gives it its own truth.
Exactly. Yeah, there's this weird dichotomy about Space 99, and there's this premise, which, you know, the Space 99 originally grew out of the idea of doing a second season of UFO, yeah. another series I love, and then they couldn't do it, and they said, well, you know, we don't want it set on Earth, it has to be set in space. It's like, so they had to, like, leave Earth behind, and I remember Johnny Byrne told me in that interview, he said, when I found out the premise, you know, that the moon was going to be, you know, basically, you know, careening around the galaxy, he said, you know, like this black cloud, you know, floated over my eyes, and he thought, how are we going to do it? But he also said, you know, John, it was our greatest weakness. You have to turn it into a strength, and that you look at the show, and they start to go into, you know, the writers start to go into these really weird ideas like time warps that like separate the moon into two yeah. distinct bodies, and like they catch up with themselves, or they go through space, you know, their location altering phenomenon, space warp. There's the Black Sun episode, which is a black hole, as you said, you know, where they travel through and are catapulted, you know, to the other side of the galaxy. It's like they were clearly, the premise is ridiculous, and yet also it like paved the way for this weird sort of trippy 70s storytelling that if you didn't have such a bizarre premise, they probably never would have arrived at these stories in some sense. And the dichotomy there, I mean, you're right. I mean, let's face it. I mean, on Star Trek, I think we saw someone in an environmental or spacesuit maybe once or twice down on the planet in Naked Time and Kirk and Tholian Webb. But it's like Space 99 was trying to grapple in its own way with its bizarre and unrealistic premise with realism. I mean, you had the people in spacesuits and, you know, the moon had different gravity. You know, it's like, you know, yeah, they were, you know, there were airlocks that, you know, we saw them using, and, you know, they were trying to validate all the things they could validate in the world while grappling with this utterly bizarre premise. And so that's what gave actually like Space 1999 in some sense its sense of spirituality, because you had like these grounded characters who were like real, they seemed like real scientists. Like Commander Koenig, he's not a space cowboy in year one. He's like an administrator. He's the administrator of Moonbase Alpha, yeah. now thrown into this crazy, you know, happenstance. And there's something very realistic about how he's portrayed, not as like this great hero, but like as this guy trying to get by and make good decisions for his people. We have people wearing spacesuits being impacted by gravity. You know, you can't just go to every planet and not have a space. You know, you wear a space suit in your ship sometimes, even because of there's explosive decompression. You know, so it's like on one hand we have this world that is kind of realistic, where the Alphans are, where they're from, and then they are hurtled into this world where it's like, as the thing said, a world beyond imagination. You know, and that's where they're grappling with all these alien ideas, these mind-blowing concepts and things that they're just not psychologically or really technologically equipped to handle.
Because there was a mandate, wasn't there, that aside from the first episode, like many shows of the era, that there could be no continuity running for the first season. Is that right, if I recall rightly? That apart from right. Breakaway, the rest had to carry its own... actually, no, there's one that does carry a link to Breakaway, isn't there, where the Ambassador character is Black... Is it Black Sun? No, it's not.
It's Earthbound. That's where Earthbound. Roy Dotrice yeah. played Simmons, and he was still there.
Yeah.
Right, and then it dispatched with him quickly. But, you know, again, what Johnny Byrne said to me, he said, John, we were learning our way. He said, because in the first book I ever wrote was about Space 1999, and I agree with what you said. There's like, you can watch these episodes in any particular order, but if you watch them in the order they wrote them, like they were getting better at figuring out how to tell stories in this weird framework. And Johnny Byrne said to me, he said, you know, I liked your book so much because you're right. He said, they all had to be individual, but the Alphans were learning as we were learning. So there is sort of this ad hoc story arc in Space 1999, that first year, you know, and you can like signify like points on that arc. Like Black Sun is an early episode, and Professor Bergman, played by Barry Morse, says something along the lines of, have you ever wondered how we survived? We couldn't have survived. Something happened. You know, something beyond what we know happened, because we should not have survived the initial accident that blew us out of orbit. So like, that's setting up some kind of mystery. There's something going on more than this. And then, you know, you go along and you find like these breadcrumbs across the year, culminating with the final episode, Testament of Arcadia, also written by Johnny Byrne, by the way, where he... where it's like they've been led to this world to bring life back to this world, and it was the world that brought life to Earth, human life to Earth, however many generations ago, and now they've arrived back at this world, Arcadia, and they're bringing the seeds of life to that world as Arcadia brought to Earth in the prehistoric past. I mean, it's sort of a proto-Prometheus or something, you know? It's very interesting. It's like there is, you know, if you look really hard at those 24 first-year episodes, you can see a development. It's not a fully enunciated arc the way we understand it today, but it is sort of a prehistoric or, you know, beginning of arc storytelling in some way, if you do watch it that way. But you don't have to. I mean, a lot of people don't see that, but I know Johnny Byrne was very gratified. I said, look at the breadcrumbs, you know, through the season. Look where they're pointing to. You know, you have your beginning point, and you have all these sort of signifiers throughout the year where the Alphans find out maybe just one thing. And it's not every episode. And then it leads to that point at the end of year one. And, you know, Koenig is talking about we all have to believe that we have a purpose. And it's like, wow, this is an episode about what was your purpose? How did you survive? How did you end up here? And in the 70s, a lot of people, Star Trek was very popular. I love Star Trek, not trying to put it down. Star Trek is like, you know, boom, we control our own destiny. Science, technology unchained, great stuff. Love it. Space 1999 was so different because it was saying, it was this concept of like the mysterious unknown force. Was there some force out there that caused this to happen, allowed us to survive, and brought us to this point? And if so, what does that mean?
There was, and again, well, this isn't, again, one of the beautiful things about Space 1999 is that there is a very strong sort of fan community around it, some of which analysed the show, some of it tried to recreate elements of the show. There was one, I mean, I've just been trying to find it. There was one guy who did an alternate episode order for season one on the basis that he felt that if you actually put them in a certain order, you could create a certain unintended but rational chronology that would actually sort of help give the show some more structure. And he sort of looks to sort of put certain episodes which suggest that they aren't sort of possibly within or near the solar system at the beginning, right, and then shifts Black Sun as the point which catapults them further out into the galaxy,
right,
to sort of give it that sort of feeling that, and then as he says, you can start grouping the weirder ones later on that sort of suggest you're getting further out into the realms of the unknown and the crazy the further away from Earth you get. And on as you say, which I totally agree that there is this sort of allusion, as Johnny was saying, to a sort of like a mythical quest almost, that this is the beginning of something. Right. And sadly, we don't really get much feeling of that per se through season two particularly. One of the things I think is very interesting with season one, which is possibly something we should talk about, is the actual aesthetic. The aesthetic to some degree is perhaps given what the show, the longevity more than the storyline has. There are certain things that the show did which people loved. I mean, there are people who I see on Facebook who spend a lot of time and love trying to recreate a Moonbase Alpha, either as a blueprint that functions with all the episodes, so you can sort of put all the places that were created for Moonbase Alpha within the map of Moonbase Alpha. There's others that try to recreate it from the identically through the prop use, try to identify what props were used, what pieces were used to create the Moonbase Alpha design, and there's those who recreate the Eagles, and there's a lot of arguments over scale for the Eagles, because the Eagle scale on the exterior to the interior never quite matched, for obvious reasons that there wasn't that sort of time to manpower that. So there's a lot of that sort of thing going on. So you have this lovely thing where you get people who are actually trying to sort of create a stronger reality of Space 1999 by reordering the episodes. You have people who try and rebuild it. I think it's quite great. And like I say, I find that sort of thing quite interesting, that shows. I mean, I remember, things like their stun guns, which as a kid reminded me of staple guns.
Right.
You know, they were sort of, those sort of designs, I think, were very potent, giving it its longevity. Because there's a lot, I mean, we said this in our first podcast, is one of the things that we look at is what the hell makes these shows, which are now 30 to 40 years old, still carry some form of meaning to us now. What did they give us, which has stayed with us, that's given them enough interest for us to look back, re-engage with them, and either find what we loved or find new stuff that we didn't love, or find that we don't love it anymore at all? And why has that changed? And I think Space 1999 is a very interesting one like that. As a kid, it was all these things like the guns, it was the eagles, it was the tension. One thing I think is interesting, which I don't know if you know about, but when they aired Space 1999 over here in the 90s for the first time in a long time as reruns, the first couple of episodes they did, they truncated the beginning sequence for, I assume, for time reasons. So you didn't get the this week, sort of this episode this week. And there was complaints that came in that said, why are you doing this? Why are we not seeing? Because that was obviously part of the value of the show to those people who wanted to rewatch it, was to re-engage with that memory and that excitement of having this very bombastic theme tune with these interlaced shots of the episode in between a sort of common title shot. It was something with Battlestar Galactica. Ron Moore openly said that he loved In Space 1999. He added it to Battlestar, and by season two he realized how much work is involved in having to constantly create these new title sequences each week. Tried to drop it, fans went ballistic, so he had to reinsert it, albeit 50% shorter than in season one. So these sort of things are quite interesting, aren't they? What we take from them, what is important in these shows, what brings us back to them.
I agree, and you know, those having been watching it, you know, in first run and then in 1970s in year one, there was those interstitials, everyone, those clips of the episode to come, that was like an electric jolt with that music. Now today we can say, oh, the music seems out there, but it's like you were receiving like a jolt of adrenaline or something.
Yes, absolutely.
And the clips, I mean, Space 1999, people can criticize the premise till they're green in the face, and I get that. And I understand why, and I'm not going to try to dissuade them, but it still looks so good, and the sets, the effects, the imagination behind how these worlds look in episodes like Guardian of Puri, things like that, you get this blast of these like trippy, mind-blowing images of beings and places and vistas, and you're just like, this is amazing. We don't get anything like that today. We don't. I mean, you know, the new Battlestar Galactica, for instance, like no real aliens. You know, it's the universe. Yeah. It's humans in silence, and all the worlds kind of look alike, and we all drive Hummers, and it's the same sort of technology. It's like no world building. Space 1999 could very well represent one of the pinnacles of sort of world building in science fiction television. Strange but beautiful and amazing imagery. And you know, you talk about the aesthetics of it, and I remember watching Space 1999 as a kid, and I also loved and love today Star Trek. But as a kid, I knew the future wasn't going to look like how the original series of Star Trek looked. I thought, the future's going to look like Space 1999, you know? Of course, that's wrong. It doesn't look like either. But there was this feeling watching Space 1999 when it was on, that there was one foot here and one foot in the near future, and that it was entirely plausible. And then, you know, they went into, you know, these crazy encounters they had with, I mean, you know, just mind-blowing, you know, alien worlds and stuff. And it's just so colorful and trippy and different and imaginative. And, you know, I think, you know, what pulls us back is, you know, in some sense, the feeling of excitement we felt when watching it, when we got that run of clips and we're like, oh my gosh, what is going on? What are they encountering? But then also just this sense of imagination in what they encountered, you know, some people can say, well, it was just, you know, it was a poor man's Star Trek or a rich man's Star Trek in this case, since the budget was high. You know, and that's all it really was these incredible production values. But I think it's much more than that when you see how they used the context of the 70s to create these alien worlds and things they discuss. I mean, one episode, Guardian of Piri, you know, it's this world with these, like, weird, bulby, like, lit mechanical trees, and instead of vines, they have, like, wires, and it's just this weird, weird landscape, but that whole episode is about, like, the drug culture and stuff like that, and like, what's the end result of the drug culture. So, I mean, just, to me, you know, Space 1999 is one of these things that in many ways hasn't been surpassed, even though we can laugh at the premise of it.
I think there's an interesting thing. You could say that it's the poor man's Star Trek or the rich man's Star Trek. I mean, you can swing this either way, but it sort of, as you say, reflected the 70s in the way that Star Trek to some degree reflected some of the things going on in the 60s, and some of the things it was reflecting in the 60s, people think, well, you know, it was out there and quite trippy. It wasn't really. It was actually quite establishment and quite anti the sort of hippie element of the 60s. But it did reflect some of those elements of space and the excitement of space in the 60s. You get to the 70s, you say, you get Space 1999. What I think is interesting, you get to 79 and you get the motion picture for Star Trek, and it could almost be set in the same world as Space 1999. It could be their future. The clothing, the aesthetic of the Enterprise is far closer to Moonbase Alpha than it is to the TV series of Star Trek in the 60s. The pace of the story, the sort of the overwhelming abuse, well, not abuse, but the pointlessness of technology in the face of an enemy, a potential enemy far beyond, which again, in fairness, original Star Trek did as well. I'm not taking that from Star Trek at all, but you can see a siblingness with Space 1999 more in than the original Star Trek. I don't think that's because they were trying to copy Space 1999. I think, as you say, that it was endemic of being part of the 70s and reflecting those sort of cultural questions and aesthetics which were being toyed around in that time before Star Wars shoved it in a different direction.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. Star Trek the Motion Picture has fully assimilated the worldview that Space 1999, you know, put out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting because we see a Star Trek that looks far more like Space 1999 in 1979. Think about another influential, I could do this twice, another super influential genre film of 1979, Alien. Mm-hmm. Which a lot of people have seen as, in some sense, a development of a particular Space 1999 episode called Dragon's Domain. You know, the conjunction of, like, a gothic or Lovecraftian monster and existence in the world of work-a-day technology in space with the human race. It's like, you know, there's no... Space 1999 was definitely not Space Truckers, which was what Alien was. But there was this idea of, like, okay, so we've mastered this aspect of space, but now we're going to, like, the space age is going to run right into, you know, the creature from the Black Lagoon or something like, you know, it's like, wow. Okay. So Alien, you know, clearly had some aspects that you can pull from Space 99 and say, okay, wasn't there an episode where they had, like, this guy who was unkillable and the only way to get rid of him was to blow him out of the airlock? End of Eternity. That's how they got rid of the alien. Yeah. Dragon's Domain, we go to this place and we encounter something that's so different from the way we are and so, like, hostile that we can't even sort of countenance it and understand it. And then the second movie, of course, is Disney's Black Hole, which I'm very affectionate about, but it's about the black hole, you know, some aspect of physics as actually a metaphysical journey. And you go right back to the Space 1999 episode Black Sun and you see it there. And again, I'm not saying anybody copied anybody, but I'm saying that these were all ideas that were sort of let loose and hovering out there in the 70s. And for people who want to look at Space 1999 as some crazy or poor quality anomaly, you can't really, because you can say it was dealing with all of these things in 1975 that the genre ultimately moved towards talking about in the late 70s in Star Trek, in The Black Hole, and in Alien, all films which I absolutely love.
I mean, some might argue, counter-argue, that you could see some of this in the 60s with 2001, which again was possibly, I would argue, very much ahead of its time rather than indicative of attitudes of its era, if you see what I mean. It always strikes me in the 60s as a sort of very much of an attitude of the thrillness of exploration, the sort of call back to the sort of manifest destiny of America, that, you know, you've got out there now to explore as your Wild West, which incidentally the science fiction was there to sort of replace the dying Wild West right. on television, certainly the Wild West genre, but carrying those sort of indicative themes. But yeah, I think the 70s, you get this sort of, as you say, this knockback of this sort of creating a fear that, you know, the Wild West is not out there to be dominated in that sort of manifest destiny. It's there right. to show the hubris of people who think they can go out there and dominate it and then come across things which are beyond their own potential to control. And maybe, again, as you say, things in the 70s with the sort of, you know, with Vietnam War coming to a close and all these sort of things that sort of try and sort of make you feel that you don't have control. And as you say, the Black Hole, Alien, Space 1999 are all about, as you say, this sort of lack of control and this hubris to think you can control things.
I love that. I think you're right. And I mean, you made a great point about 2001, because even the 2001, A Space Odyssey, Space 1999, some critics said, like, okay, this show is a markdown. You know, it's now 1999 from 2001, which you get. I mean, you had some of the special effects people involved. Absolutely, it does follow on 2001. It also follows, in some sense, on the weird metaphysics of a Russian film, Solaris. There's an episode, Matter of Life and Death, which has some commonalities with that, for sure. But I think, like, if you look at 2001, it's like there's the mysterious unknown force there, the monolith, for sure. But it's like you know for sure that it's, I guess, benevolent, and it's directed in the way to evolve us into whatever yeah. we're supposed to be. You know, there's this demarcation point, which I find fascinating, with Gerry Anderson at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s was going into a much more questioning phase, sort of how you were talking about, going into a darker phase. You look at his movie Doppelganger, or as we knew it in the United States, Journey to the Far Side of the Sun, and where it's like there's this alternate Earth where everything is backwards, and it's not exactly evil, but it's like this weird space mission where everything goes wrong. It's like you have all the technology, you have all the understanding, and we still like can't even understand ourselves. And then you have his UFO, which again is very dark. Aliens coming to Earth, stealing our organs, and they're sort of, again, trippy, mind-blowing plans to defeat us. You know, they're like, there's like LSD type moments in the series and stuff. Like, there's this moment in the science fiction genre where Gerry Anderson, and not to diminish in any way his previous work like Fireball XL5 or Stingray or Thunderbirds, but where it went from being overtly for children to like being almost the opposite, to like, okay, now we're in this post-2001 period where we're going to use all the technology Kubrick showed us in 2001 to visualize the story, but we're going into an era where we're questioning everything. All the pillars that we've believed in, patriotism, science, to give us answers, international cooperation, all those pillars are going down, and we're questioning every single one. And you see that from Doppelganger to UFO to Space 1999, at least year one. And then that kind of idea still is in play, even in something as humanistic and positive as Star Trek the Motion Picture, although it all ends up okay.
Yeah.
In the Black Hole, where, I mean, ostensibly a happy ending, but where are they? You know, they've transitioned from where to where, you know, exactly. An Alien with this world of these, you know, these creatures. There's still this sort of, you know, darkness sounds so cliche right now, it's going to be dark. It's not like that. It's more like, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, that can be dreamed of by our philosophy, by our science, by our technology. You know, it just like you said, it's not conquerable by us. We have to face it, and one of the biggest problems in facing it is, who are we?
Yeah.
When we face it, who are we? You know, you see that in Doppelganger, you see that in UFO, you see it so clearly in Space 1999, even the madness of Reinhardt in The Black Hole, you know. When we face these things, who are we? And Solaris was also a big part of that, I think, because that was the movie that had the line, when we go to other worlds, we don't – oh, God, I'm going to paraphrase it badly. It's like when we go to other worlds, we don't want to encounter something new. We want to encounter mirrors because we're only comfortable in relating it to ourselves. This is like sort of the mirror cracked, this kind of Space 1999. Like we get out there and the Alphans fear, their paranoia, their – the claustrophobia, all those things are just as much a danger to them as the actual aliens they encounter, if you look at episodes like War Games, where it's their fear that creates the conflict.
Absolutely. It's It's a great series like that, and I think I look back at the 70s, and one of the reasons I quite like these shows, and I'll include Star Trek in this as well, is that when you sort of move out into the 80s, which I'm sure we'll cover eventually, and you start getting a movement to sort of try and make plausibility through trying to ground things in technological narrative, or as it became known, things like technobabble. It was wonderful when we came out of that at the end of the 90s, where you get shows like Lex and Farscape, which would return to this sort of notion that Space 1999 had, that you can have technology, but ultimately what you're there for is the story, and it won't be this sort of the nuances of technology which will bring you your outcomes.
Right.
It will be something either far more humanistic or fantastical. Or surprising. I mean, Black Sun is an incredible episode, simply from the I'm going to give this away for people who haven't seen it, but essentially they're on a sort of very nihilistic course towards a black hole, essentially, and it's most of the episode is about them reconciling this and trying to escape and then realizing they can't, and then having to accept their fate, and their fate taking them into a different direction. And there was a sort of very it stood against the standard mould of narrative for me, but very much that of the 70s, especially sort of 70s fiction, of film and perhaps even book fiction. So, yeah, well, maybe we need to talk about how that changed into season two. Because there was a lot of changes. We lost some of the core cast. Barry Gray, who was known from The Fugitive, who was great in season one. He disappears. Nick Tate stays.
Nick Tate stays.
Alan stays. But a couple of the other minor, Paul disappears.
Right. We lose Kano and Paul. Right.
Yeah, and Kano. Yeah, I forgot about Kano. and you lose even the main central set, which was this very big, epic main mission set where everyone sort of, where the main discourse is carried out, and was reduced to this very truncated, smaller set. Which some fans have argued was a sort of underground base that the main mission was destroyed and they had to relocate to smaller quarters. But basically there was a lot of changes in cast, there was a lot of changes in the aesthetic, there was a lot of changes in the narrative structure. How do you feel about season two? And do you want to just sort of explain, as you say, why these sort of changes occurred and what?
Well, you know, one of the things I loved about Space 1999 is always colorful. Sometimes people make the mistake of thinking, well, it's sort of very black and white looking as far as Alpha is, but all the alien worlds were like extremely colorful. So when I think of Space 1999 Year One and the aesthetics, I think it's like the black and white concrete world of humanity in 1999 goes out into this way out colorful out of the world of the future. Year two changed that grounding in some sense because now we weren't having like unisex sort of costumes. We were having like the women were now wearing skirts and all the men were wearing bold, colorful jackets. You know, Martin Landau had like an orange jacket and he also had like a black one. Helena Russell got a blue jacket. You know, it's like suddenly and this like even the sets like were a lot more colorful. They're a lot more like colored winky lights kind of thing, blinky lights, you know, in Command Center than there were in Main Mission. It was like, there was this idea like we're going to color it up and we're going to make Moonbase Alpha home. You know, one of the key things in year one was, you know, we're stuck on this hermetically sealed coffin in space and, you know, we can't have children here. We were limited to the number of people we had. We have to make all of these difficult choices. And there were episodes about that. Like there was one episode where they found a generation ship where people were like cannibalizing each other because they didn't have the resources. Yeah. And one of the people, that was Mission of the Darians. And Alan said to Conan, if the same thing happened on Alpha, would you choose differently? And like he said, remind me to tell you sometime or something. Like that. It's like he totally evaded the question. And it was because, let's face it, these are desperate people. And when desperation hits, you don't get to choose between good options. So Alpha was this place that, yes, it was the home base for the episode, but it was like, we're not going to be able to grow here. We have to find a place where we can grow and be human again. And year two was very much like, no, this is the central set of our TV show. We love it here. We're all happy and having fun and we're smiling and telling jokes. And this core conceit of the series, sort of the desperation in some sense of the characters to find a new home to be able to survive, was lost. There were instances in year two where they met advanced aliens who were not hostile, and instead of raising their hand saying, please take us with you back to your planet, you know, they just stay on the moon. You know, it's like, okay. You know, the whole the whole feeling changed. It was like more like an American TV show of the time, and it was very true of the time. You want people to feel comfortable. It's like, oh, the people here on Moonbase Alpha are happy, and they're giggly, and they tell jokes, and they're in love, and they're, see, isn't it nice the way they're relating to each other? It's less sort of hostile, and there's less isolation and remoteness. But in doing that, they took away some of Space 1999's specialness, I feel. I mean, it's great that you have all the banter on Star Trek. You know, the people in Star Trek live in a near-perfect world. Their starships can travel faster than light. They got their matter replicators. They can beam up and down. It's a universe where you've conquered all these things. You know, Space 1999 was different. And, you know, a moon that's out of control is not a place where you'd need to, like, have that kind of banter and fun and, like, evoke family feelings. So, like, the very undercurrent of Space 1999 changed dramatically. Now, also, the feeling was that you had to have more action and less sort of talking about philosophical issues. That it had to become a less contemplative series and become a more action-packed series. So the conflicts were often very much reduced to physical conflicts. I mean, they encountered a godlike character in Matter of Life and New Adam, New Eve, who was like controlling the Alphans, and the way they got rid of him was like he drew his power from the sun, so like they dug a hole and he tricked him into a pit. I mean, it was like we like reduced the grandeur and epic quality of these conflicts and these issues to literally physical things, like how can I physically overcome you? And in Star Trek, that's fine. Hornblower, whatever. It's a universe where we had much more control. It was ridiculous to assume that the Alphans would be able to exert that level of control in their circumstances in year two. That said, I will be one of those people who argues till my dying day that Catherine Schell was a great addition to the cast. Maya, first, I guess, regular live-action shapeshifter on a TV series, before Odo, before others. She was great. I thought... she busted the sort of resident alien cliche at that time on Space 1999, and that she was not someone who had no emotions. You know, in like the 60s and 70s, like everybody who was a resident alien or experience, like they had no emotions like Spock. Well, she did have a genius mind like Spock, but she was an imp. She had a sense of humor. She had a sort of delight about herself, and maybe that made her more human, but I felt like her character worked. I didn't always agree how they used her, but if they were going into this area where they were supposed to exert more control, well, then I guess Maya fit that format because she was able to help them exert more control. I guess that would be my point.
So do you think those were the reasons it failed? I mean, Space Nine, it was, as you said earlier, it was Freeburger who'd done season 3 of Star Trek, which is not generally considered one of the best seasons.
Right.
I won't say Spock's brain because you very recently were defending that in very well as well, but certainly had some questionable episodes and questionable tone.
I don't think it's a good episode. I just don't think it's the worst.
No, and I totally agree with you on all those points. And again, actually, to be fair, and again, if you've not read his go to John's blog to read his bit about Spock's brain. If you've not seen Spock's brain, it's an episode where essentially Spock's brain goes missing in Star Trek, and it is very odd and lacking science and really lacking any true sort of belief in the universe. But it is very watchable, and I would almost sort of say that does sort of sit within season 2 of Space 1999. I remember watching them a few years ago, and actually, even though they weren't as straight, I never felt that Landau looked quite as comfortable, even though I know Landau had issues with the first season as well. But it kind of, there was a sort of, they were still quite enjoyable to watch, even if they weren't sort of particularly deep or impressionable.
Absolutely, and I'm glad you brought that up because I recently finished like watching Logan's Run, the series. I watched recently, friend, in the last 3 years or so, Star Lost, The Fantastic Journey, and so like anybody who says like year two of Space 1999 is bad, I say go watch some of these other shows and see how inconsistent they are and how they like break believability so much in the kind of stories they tell. So I mean, yeah, I am okay with Space 1999 year two. I like it a lot. There are many stories that I appreciate and can defend. I like The Metamorph, which was the season premiere. I very much enjoyed The Exiles. I think there are, there's Journey to Where, a sort of time traveler story. There are a lot of good stories there. It's just that it's Space 1999, sort of
light.
Yeah, light. It's been reduced somehow. It's like before the whole universe and like every idea. It's like things we're gonna like look at thing in terms of ideas and philosophy and metaphysics. And now it's like just very grounded. It's like you come here, you want to steal my life support system, you're going to challenge me, and then I'm going to have to kick your ass. I mean, that's sort of what a lot of the episodes are. I mean, we had a lot of stories where aliens come from, something like the Beta Cloud or Bringers of Wonder, which aren't bad stories actually, but they're like here to get our life support, to get the Alphans life support supply. And you can see, but John, isn't that also like the same premise? You know, resources are limited, and they want ours. And I say, yeah, it is, but there's something so reduced about how those episodes are executed. You know,
it's a political mirroring in a weird way. In the first one, you're sort of sitting in a sort of very progressive bubble where you're realizing your equipment is finite, your world is finite, you need a place to try and go forward away from where you are, because where you are is just not sustainable. While right. In season two, you've got a far more sort of conservative approach. She's saying, this is ours, it is finite, it is ours, we therefore can't share, therefore we will fight to defend our home tooth and claw. We're not really that interested in sort of progressing on. We're here to try and maintain an equilibrium, a tradition almost.
That's a perfect way of describing it. Gosh, that is amazing. Yeah, you just said that. That's the best I've ever heard that put. I wish I could have said it like that.
Well, it only came from you talking. It's a reflection on what you're saying here. I've never considered it before, but that does fit in with what you were saying earlier about season two being like their home rather than a transitional, and that does have a sort of social political ramification to it.
Oh, absolutely, you're right. In year two, it's like they were there to protect what they had, but in year one, it's like they realized that they didn't have what they needed and had to find a place. That they were the ones who had to go out and say, can we live here? Can we exist here? Can we be humans here? In stories like Guardian of Piri or The Last Enemy or things like that, where it's like, what are these other cultures out there, and can we be a part of that? And, the door is slammed on them, or they realize for some reason it's not compatible. You know, the shoe's on the other foot in year two. Everybody wants what they have, and they're the ones slamming the door. We can't share our lives. Which I mean, they couldn't, but it's just a different turn on the format, as you said. It's going from sort of needing someone to saying we have everything we need. I guess you could say it was more like what Johnny Byrne said in Voyager. It's like, well, we have all our stuff. Don't mess with us.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
I think the other problem with season two for a lot of fans, as we mentioned, there was a lot of cast changes and there was a lot of unhappiness within the cast about contracts and how they were contacted and dealt with. Nick Tate, I think, took a stand and all sorts. But there was, for fans or people watching the show, critics, as me and Christian were saying the other day on the other podcast, we do dislike this term fans, when a lot of what we do, like what we're doing here, is more critical than it is about protectionism, as fandom is really about protectionism, right, of something that you feel is precious to you. I like to think we're more critical. But what is those sort of gaps? They're not plot holes, and of course there were many in Space 1999, but you sort of what happened to the professor, what happened to Paul and Kano, what happened, and of course the big one is that what happened after series two, which Johnny Byrne sort of tried to answer a little, didn't he, in the little short that was done. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Absolutely. I mean, I was there when he unveiled it at the convention.
I figured you must have been.
Yes. He said to me, we became fast friends there. And he mentored me going into the next decade, because I was working on my web series and I wanted to capture some of Space 1999's kind of ethos and figure out how do you do that. And we talked about that, and that's where he told me things like you figure out what your weakness is and turn it into a strength. And so we had like many talks about that, like about the Blair Witch Project, for instance, which sounds like a weird thing to talk about with someone from Space 1999. But we talked about, he said they took the fact that they had nothing and they made,
yeah.
and they used that to scare you to death. He said, you know, if you have nothing, that's what you have to figure out how you're going to do. Is how are you going to impact people with nothing? So figure out what your weakness is and turn it into your strength. So he I remember the first time I met him, he was like coming down the hallway and he had my book in hand. This was like one of the greatest honors of my career. He said, I want you to sign my book, because I had sent it to him. And, you know, we became great friends, and he kept saying, we're going to have a surprise at the end of the convention, John. Make sure you stay. Don't leave before the end. And that's where we saw a message from Moonbase Alpha, which was basically initiating sort of another phase of Space 99, saying they had left the moon base, found a planet to colonize, and, you know, that's where it was ending. So it functioned as an end, but it could also function as a new beginning. And I know he very much wanted to continue. To continue this journey, you know, in the way they had in year one, although he would be the first to tell you he liked some aspects of year two and would have wanted to incorporate those in, had he done that. He was a very gracious gentleman about all of that. He was clear that he thought year two went the wrong way, but he also said, you know, I watched the Metamorph recently and it was fantastic. You know, it had action, it had color, it had pace, it had all these things. So Message for Moonbase Alpha was designed as both an end point and I guess a transition point to something else, which unfortunately never came, unless you're reading the Powys Media books. You know, I've written a couple of those officially licensed Space 1999 novels. I did a novel, The Forsaken, which basically bridged year one and year two. William Latham has written so many books, taking the Alphan journey on. I wrote another one, The Whispering Sea, which explained how Maya went from being an outsider on Alpha in one episode to in the very next episode being the science officer. You know, completely accepted and completely accepting. You know, so, you know, what you said is right. I mean, there are these gaps in Space 1999, and I actually don't think that's a totally bad thing, because I think what has kept the passion alive for a lot of people is that they're able to sort of say, okay, you gave us this work of art and it's like 7/10 or 8/10 complete, but what about and we fill in the rest with our imagination, you know, based on what you gave us. And that's how you have the novels, that's how you have the movie and so forth. So
I mean, it was wonderful as well to have some form of coda. I know some form of coda which had some sort of legitimacy, which shouldn't matter, but it's nice to carry a little bit of legitimacy. And it's a shame that, you know, things like Barry Morse. I know I said Barry Gray, who was the composer of the, I think Barry Morse's character, Bergman, right, disappearing Paul Cano. And I am really glad that you have these opportunities where fans or critiques, or maybe in that sense fans, can come back and sort of fill in those holes a little bit. If you go into the actual Space 99 community, you'll see some very in-depth analysis of each episode, which show all the errors and the problems, and there's no way you can bridge them all. But in a way, I've always sort of Space 1999, I've always liked to think of it as that sort of mythic journey where things perhaps didn't make total sense, as if things perhaps were not quite of this world or of this universe, that it was a right. It was a trip somewhere further beyond, and things didn't make total sense. You know, there was that sort of, I don't know, harking back to 2001 and the right. Monolith. You know, it's almost like as soon as moon is blasted out of Earth's orbit, they're sort of monolithed into
I have a cat. There's a cat here meowing at you. I'm so sorry. She's gotten
it's
into
okay.
Her. Go ahead, James. I'm so sorry.
I think we've had this before. This had this last time, I think, in episode one of this weird.
I'm so sorry.
Crazy series. But you've got, you know, so it doesn't quite function totally, but it's sort of, I don't know. There is something quite, as you say, you kept saying this word trippy, and there is something quite trippy about Space 1999, which I'd recommend everyone to watch if you can. It's a brilliant series. For all its faults, I think it still stands up well, because, as I say, it doesn't really rely on technology. It is a lot of it about sort of either pulp fiction or about sort of broader moral concepts or mythic concepts. There is a lot of mythic concepts which are re-energized through science fiction, which was very common at the time. Brilliant. So do you have, I just thought we could finish, do you want to sort of, could you name five of your favorite episodes, if you were to say to people five episodes you'd like them to watch, if you were going to sort of give someone who was bare, had not seen it before, and you thought five episodes which would sort of give them a feeling of what you're talking about, and at least one of them's got to be from season two.
You had to put that caveat on. Okay.
Well, I think
well,
so.
Okay, I think it's essential to watch Breakaway.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we didn't talk about as well, but and we don't need to go into, but is one way to look at Space 1999 is that, you know, space is this sort of terrain of terror, and I've written before about like the horror mythology of Space 1999 and how it translates our technology that we have into like it like gives new life to old horror tropes. So another episode I would recommend in my top five is Earthbound. Now that's the one with Christopher Lee,
yeah,
and Roy Dotrice, and it's sort of the premature burial, let's
yes.
say.
It is quite horrific, isn't it?
It is quite horrific and stunning. It might have a couple slow points in the middle, but the ending of that is sort of worthy of the Twilight Zone for sure. So I would pick I'd pick Breakaway, I'd pick Earthbound, I'd pick Black Sun.
Yeah.
Okay, that's three. Oh my gosh. Okay. I happen to love Another Time, Another Place. I'm totally failing at this. Okay. Because I can't just pick five from year one. And I already didn't mention Dragon's Domain or Testament of Arcadia. Okay, let me go back to the beginning. Let's do Breakaway, which sets up the premise of the series. Let's do Dragon's Domain, which is the most famous episode. It's one that people have never forgotten.
Yeah.
40 years later, and which, you know, scarred some people for sure.
And it gave a little bit of backstory to Space 1999, which was a little unusual too.
Exactly, we got to see the history of the character. So yeah, that's a great one. So let's say we're gonna say Breakaway, Dragon's Domain, and then you can sub in, I think, either like Mission of the Darians, End of Eternity, or Force of Life. Those are all quite amazing stories. And then I guess I should pick two from year two. I think I would pick The Metamorph, which introduces Maya. And golly, what other one would I want from year two? Okay, I am going to say The Exiles. We get a little bit of philosophy about how Koenig has changed between the years, actually. And there's a scene where he has to like test the aliens, and he like shoots one point blank range, and they discuss there about the limits of their life support system, things like that. I think that episode works. So, James, I would love to hear your five. You put me on the spot, but before we go, give me your five.
It's harder for me because my season two is very vague. it's been a while since I've watched season two. I would certainly, I mean, I think yes, you've got to have Breakaway, just so you set it up. I would agree with you on Dragon's Domain, because again, I think that gives you a little bit of interesting mythology, as much as it gives you the sort of horror aspect, which I think is good. As I've said, Black Sun is one again that I would sit with. Ones that are very popular I don't like. I've never been keen on War Games. I think it's a brilliant episode, but I always hate episodes which have the twist at the end which sort of negates much of what's happened. It always feels it cops out. And I don't think there would have been any harm in having them reach the same conclusion without having to reboot it. You could have happily imagined that there could have been a lot of repairing, a lot of work done in between, sort of brought to the brink of destruction. So War Games sort of fails slightly for me, and I know it's a very popular one. I'm just trying to think if I can sort of go outside your list, and I see I'm trying to remember them as well, which ones I sort of really touched me. I kind of like Last Sunset.
Oh golly, yeah, that's a sort of haunting episode in some ways.
That one always sits with me, so I think I'd put Last Sunset. Season two has an issue with me, is unlike you, I find Maya very jarring. She just, I mean, if she was just as she was, I'd be fine. But the whole gimmick of the metamorph just doesn't function for me well. It just takes it too far away from what Space 1999 is, even though it's quite plausible within their universe. They never really, as you say, integrate it. And I can totally see where you could get a novel out of trying to sort of justify that integration into their society. Tony as well, I have problems with Tony. There's just something so sadly bland about the way that they sort of bring this character and who they give no justification to at all,
right?
Either I don't know, is Dawkins the Troughton one?
Yes, and that one isn't very popular for some folks, but I think it's one of the better episodes of the season because it's so sort of desperate.
Yeah, I quite like the Dorkons, so I'd probably run with the Dorkons. So yeah, my list actually for season one probably isn't horrendously different to yours. I still don't really think there's that many bad ones in season one. I think they all have their own sort of gentle wonder and fun to them. And which is the one with the ghost?
Oh, that's the troubled spirit.
The troubled spirit's an unusual one. Again, it's a bit messed up. It doesn't quite work.
Right.
But again, it's another one of those examples where Space 1999 takes an idea. The actual resolution isn't particularly powerful, but the sort of pacing is unusual, and it's the sort of build-up. The end doesn't quite translate, but the sort of movement throughout the story is quite interesting. I'm not sure it really speaks well for Koenig's character, but again, yeah, there's a lot of interesting ones there that you can pick from. So yeah, all I think we're saying is that give it a go. I will see if I can send with... I think I found the season list that was argued. It's Steve's version of Space 1999. I'll see if I can get the URL with the blog so you can all have a look at it. If you do watch them, and the DVD box sets I don't think are horrendously expensive. I'm not sure if they're on any of the streamers. I'm sure there are other ways that people can see them.
It is on Hulu.
It is on Hulu. There you go. Brilliant. Thank you. It's on Hulu. Try and watch it in this order, because I started doing that. When I rewatched Space 1999, I watched it on the order that I found on this website, which I thought made a lot of sense. I'll send it to John in a second so he can have a little peruse. But I think we'll end there. I don't know what we'll talk about next time. This has been fascinating. I love Space 1999. I still think it's kind of funny that the Comlocks perhaps in some ways do represent where technology went, the multi-purpose tool. So I don't think...
smartphone.
Exactly. So there's some stuff in there which isn't too far removed from where reality went. We will have various ways we can give comments and feedback. We had some very nice ones on John's blog for the first episode that we've done, and that was much appreciated. Some people filling in a few holes where we'd missed details, which was really good. Cool. So thank you for that. So anything that you do say, and if you're listening and you're one of the fans or critiques of John and his work, do keep leaving stuff on his blog, because I read those and I thought that was really cool. It's really nice to hear what people think. Okay, thank you very much. We will talk to you again on this irregular podcast sometime in the future, maybe hopefully before 1999 and the moon gets blasted out of orbit as the future. These are so many weird futures, isn't there? You know, we've got, you know, poor old Buck Rogers getting lost in 1987 on the last deep space probe, and you know, 1999 Farscape as well. You know, all these things to look forward to. Okay, take care, everyone.
Thank you.